This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A new soccer team begins play in Kalamazoo this spring. Coming up, Mike Garrett tells us about his plans for the National Premier Soccer League franchise. But first,
who is responsible for the decisions that led to Flint's water crisis? And why did it take so long for the lead contamination to be reported and for action to be taken? Many people have written and talked about that. The website 538 looks at where the testing of water for lead fell short and what that has meant to Flint's residents in a story called What Went Wrong in Flint. Anna Maria Berry-Jester reports on public health, food, and culture for 538. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So how did the Flint water crisis come onto your radar as a story or at a national publication? You could cover all sorts of things. What made you decide to actually go to Flint and look into it yourself?
Yeah, so I've been following pretty closely what has been going on there since the late summer. I've written a lot about lead poisoning in the past, and it's something I think is very interesting. It, you know, disproportionately affects communities of color and lower socioeconomic families and that kind of thing. And, you know, I'm very interested in sort of this idea called the social determinants of health. So I had been kind of following and paying attention. I'm from Michigan originally, but I just feel like this story has sort of national implications in how we think about regulation and how we think about safety and keeping people safe in terms of environmental exposures.
Where in Michigan are you from?
I grew up in the Lansing area.
Okay. Similar to Nate Silver, right?
Yeah.
The founder of 538. So you take us through here some of the problems, and you say that, for one thing, against federal guidelines, they chose not to require the Flint water plant to use optimized corrosion control. This is the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality that you're mm-hmm. writing about. They took two samples, took them in the wrong places, and they excluded two samples whose inclusion ended up skewing the results. So let's go through these here just one by one. First of all, the corrosion control. I've heard it said that for a relatively small amount of money, this all could have been avoided with some corrosion control measures. Based on what you've found in your reporting, is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't even seem to have been a cost-cutting measure. And I think there's an enormous amount of information that's still missing on why that decision was made and who exactly made that decision. I've talked to a lot of engineers. You know, Mark Edwards has been at the center of this. I've talked to several others who say it's just sort of unbelievable. They can't understand why there wasn't corrosion control put in the water, especially when you look at, I mean, just for any water source, that should have been the case probably, and especially when you look at sort of the conditions of the Flint River.
So too few samples and from the wrong places. Where were they getting their samples from?
Yeah, so the law requires that you sample from the highest risk homes. The idea is to find the worst case scenarios and see, you know what I mean, that you're really trying to uncover the worst cases. So in the case of Flint, they don't have a map of where all the lead pipes are in the city. And they, you know, it's not that map is required by law, but how do you test for the highest risk homes if you don't know where the city's lead pipes are, as well as the residential lead pipes? So that's kind of a problem. The other thing that's, again, you know, this is something that's probably going to need to be adjudicated between the EPA and the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, but the law requires that for a city of 100,000 people, you take 100 samples. And originally, that's what Flint set out to do, and they had a hard time getting those 100 samples, and so they dropped the requirement down to 60. And, you know, yeah, technically there may be a few people less than 100,000, but that right there probably could have caused some problems in terms of the sampling methodology.
Was there a reason given as to why they were having trouble getting to the proper number of samples?
You know, in some of the emails that have been put out in the Freedom of Information Act request, it looks like, you know, they sort of, it's hard to say. First of all, there were not that many people in the city of Flint working on this. So, you know, you've got one person going out and doing this in addition to a whole bunch of other jobs. So just to be fair on that, but they seem to imply that they weren't getting a lot of, the residents weren't working with them. You know, then on the other hand, when the Virginia Tech researchers went in later, which we can get to, but they really had a tremendous response. It's maybe an unfair comparison because at that point people were worried about the water. But, you know, it does speak to there's probably some tensions between the city and the residents as is around the water. There were already these big questions around the costs of their water bills. And I think, you know, there is a lot of mistrust between city officials and the residents, unfortunately.
And then there were two samples that were thrown out and not included in the study. What did that do to the results?
Right. So the federal law says that if 10% of the samples are over the 15 parts per billion, which is called the actionable level, meaning that there's too much lead in the water, there's no safe amount of lead, but they have to create a cutoff point when they're doing these tests. And if over 10% of the tests are over that 15 parts per billion, you have to take a bunch of actions, including doing better corrosion control and letting residents know that there's a potential risk. When they threw out those two samples, those two alone made it so that it dropped from being above 10% of samples having high lead to less than 10% of samples having high lead.
So you end up talking to this self-taught scientist from Flint, Leanne Walters, and she kind of unpacked this whole idea of how we know that there was no corrosion control, because people were kind of questioning, how can that be the case, right? How can this be coming back if there's no corrosion control? And her answer is, there's no corrosion control.
Yeah, she's really remarkable. There are a lot of residents who've been working really hard on this, and, she's one of them, but she kind of was at the center of this story largely because she went down to the city and asked for, basically all the documents she could get on what was going on with the water and water treatment. And in that, she saw that they were not using these, corrosion controls, they're multi-flowable chemicals and that kind of thing. And she figured out what was going on and was able to communicate that to the EPA officials that she had reached out to on her own.
There also was a question here about where they were getting these samples, right? That depending on which part of the city you're in, you may get some very different results.
Right, because, different parts of the city were built at different times. Some parts of the city are more affluent and maybe have had their pipes changed over the years. There's a lot of reasons that this could be concentrated in different neighborhoods. And they did sample in some of the highest risk neighborhoods. So, and I'm not trying to imply that they were purposely necessarily going to places that were low risk. It's really hard to say, but they definitely didn't sample across the city. And since they didn't really have evidence of where the highest risk homes would be, you can kind of say that they definitely weren't complying with the federal regulation in that sense.
A couple of other things that you get into here are kind of interesting. They're a little technical, but still maybe show here what some of the problems were. One, that residents were asked to test water after doing sitting for more than 6 hours, as required by federal law. But they were also asked to flush the systems the night before, and that so-called pre-flush may lead to lower detection in samples. So that may also put those sample rates off, right?
Right. So when the lead and copper rule, which is the federal law that kind of oversees this, was written about 25 years ago, and sampling methodology was different. So it's kind of vague how it's written in the law. And the DEQ, says that they were complying with the law, but every expert, a water expert I talked to, said, these are just not best practices anymore. And even some people even call them sort of loopholes that cities use to get around doing more rigorous testing. And this is one of them. So, the water has to be standing for more than 6 hours. Because if you think about it, when you get up in the morning, you go get a glass of water, it's been sitting there for a long time. That's kind of the highest risk scenario. But what they were having residents do is clean out the system the night before. And so that's not required, and that is known to reduce the chances of catching lead in the water.
And you normally don't clean out your system the night before.
Exactly. Who runs their water for, 2 to 5 minutes before they go to bed? No, nobody does that. So, the whole point of this law is really to try and find the worst case scenarios. And when you do a lot of these things that they were doing, it reduces the chances of finding lead in the water. And you don't want to reduce the chances. You want to find the high risk.
And then also, samples were collected in bottles with a small neck, which to the layman doesn't sound like a big deal, but it is something else that may also influence the results. Explain how.
Right. So, and again, it's all about trying to mimic what people really do when they use their water. So when you go to fill up a glass of water, you can open the tap at any speed and you're going to get all the water into the glass. If you're trying to fill up something that looks like a soda bottle where it has a small neck, you have to run a slower stream. And that slower stream is less likely to have, you know, lead in it than the heavier stream. And so, again, all these things reduce the chances of you finding lead, but they also don't mimic the way that people actually use their water at home.
Now, you mentioned the name earlier of Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech, and a lot of people have been hearing this name over the last several weeks. So how does the lead contamination crisis of water in Flint get the attention of a guy who is in Virginia, at Virginia Tech?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So Leanne Walters, you know, this Flint resident, had reached out to the EPA. And this is a small community of people who are trying really hard to better understand ways that we should be testing, what we might be missing in the water, and who've had experiences in other cities where they, you know, poor testing led to not detecting dangerous levels of lead, like in Washington, D.C. So this man from the EPA, Miguel Del Borrell, reached out to Mark and asked him if he could send Leanne to do independent testing of her water. So she had the city test her water. But, you know, as is kind of standard practice, they also wanted somebody independent to test. And so Leanne reached out to Mark, and Mark did that independent testing.
There's a lot of criticism, which has been justifiably leveled at the state. There have also been some questions raised about the Environmental Protection Agency. The Region 5 administrator here in the Midwest has resigned, apparently in part in response to this crisis in Flint. But as you've done this story and met these people, would you also say that we've had the chance to learn about some real, for lack of a better word, heroes out there who are trying to do the right thing in the face of what seems to be a big-time mess-up at several levels?
Yeah, I mean, I think heroes is exactly the right word. There's been a group of residents, as well as, you know, a broader swath of residents who've been protesting and whatnot, but there's been a group of residents who really, even with all these public officials and experts saying, you're wrong, you know, this experience that you think you're having isn't what you think it is, they've sort of persevered and gathered the data and evidence and really fought back. And I think that's so impressive. I mean, it's hard to imagine what it would be like to have somebody tell you, no, you're safe, when you really, you know, even with their children and with their own bodies, they could feel that something was wrong. And I it's incredibly powerful to me what they did. I really feel like if they hadn't been so persistent, we wouldn't know that this had happened.
And we should include in that list the pediatrician, Mona Hannah Atisha, who was seeing these elevated levels of lead and really worked to bring it to the attention of people who needed to find out about this and do something about it.
Right. And, that was really the turning point when everything shifted. So, yes, they found lead, in the months sort of just leading up to that. But it was saying, okay, no, we don't just have lead in the water, but it's affecting our children. I think that was what was so powerful to especially state officials to realize that, wow, there really was a problem on their hands and they had to deal with it.
Those of us who have read 538 for a while in its various forms and various places it's been affiliated with know that it relies heavily on data to tell us things like, for instance, who's going to win an election, also in terms of sports. This obviously is a story with data. How important was it for you that you got to spend time on the ground in Flint and therefore you were able to link data to the human experience?
Yeah, that was so important. I mean, one, just to be able to understand what this experience was like for Flint residents and what kind of the data meant for them. But also, to me, as much as a story like that included data, it was a story about how that data came to be, right? It was, we had this official data that wasn't really telling us what we needed to know. And then you have these people who, some of them were experts and some of them were residents, but they kind of all stepped outside of their normal capacity as citizens and did things to gather data that became ultimately so important in understanding what had happened.
Do you think there is a broader lesson there for all of us to learn going forward about how we should react when we hear official data, perhaps that we should treat that with a little more skepticism than we have in the past?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I want to say that everyone should distrust everything they hear from public officials. Of course not. You know, there's wonderful people working out there keeping people safe in cities all over the country. But, Yeah, I mean, if something doesn't seem right, I think it's really important to ask questions. And ultimately, those questions that residents continue to ask are, again, it's why we know this happens. And I do think there's a big lesson to learn in the sense that citizens are the best keepers of a lot of information. They know what's going on in their homes. There's no way a city official can know what's coming out of every individual's tap. And if you feel like something's wrong, it's important to ask questions. I think that's a big takeaway here.
Anna Maria Berry-Jester, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Anna Maria Berry-Jester reports on public health, food, and culture for 538. You can find a link to her story, What Went Wrong in Flint, at our website, WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Sports fans, specifically soccer fans in the Kalamazoo area, will have a new option this year. A National Premier Soccer League expansion team will begin play this spring. Mike Garrett is the man leading the effort to launch the new soccer team in Kalamazoo. Mike Garrett, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us why you think a new soccer team can work in Kalamazoo.
Well, soccer has been tried before here, but it's a great soccer market. You and I were kind of just chit-chatting about that before we got started. Thousands of kids playing, a lot of adults playing. I'm the founder of Soccer Zone. We have 10,000 people a week to play soccer in our building in the winter. So there's a huge base of support. I think our challenge, of course, is to engage them in a new team and get them to games.
Yeah. Does it always follow that people who enjoy playing soccer and, you know, perhaps they're doing it, you know, to get exercise and that sort of thing, that they're necessarily going to say, well, hey, I'm going to go spend a couple hours of my time some night to watch a team in Kalamazoo?
Doesn't always follow. You know, I'm an ex-professional player from back in the 80s when indoor soccer professionally was a really big deal. And we played in some arenas with 17,000 people there. We played in some with 1,700. And I think the difference really was the market and the type of job the ownership group did. People love to play the game. Your question's great. Everyone who's played really enjoys, it's the reason it's the world's most popular sport at every level. But yeah, our challenge is going to be to engage people in the team. I think it's a different time. I mean, you know, it's soccer's been tried here before, but people can watch the game on TV. They are more interested in higher-level soccer. I think people follow players more than they used to as they progress. And, you know, we're just hoping we can contribute to that and have some local players participate in this team and use this as a vehicle to improve their game.
Specifically, who are the players that are going to compete in this soccer team at Kalamazoo?
Yeah, the league, let me tell you about this league. It's really interesting. There's 80 teams across the country in this league, so it's probably the largest league, I don't know if it's in the world or not, that's at a level like this, but it's certainly in the United States. And there are professional teams in this league and fully amateur teams, so which is really kind of interesting. So some of the teams, like New York Cosmos, which is a famous team in the U.S., kind of resurrected itself. They have what they call Cosmos B plays in this league, and they're professional players. They play with the first team and they play with the second team, depending on injuries or younger players or what have you. And those guys are fully professional players. Most of the teams in this league are amateur players, typically the core of the team being current college players who are playing in their off season as a way to train, compete, and improve, and hopefully go back in the fall as a better player. But also some of them obviously looking to get to the full professional level. So this is an opportunity for them to train and improve. So we are the second one. We're really looking to have current college players, maybe some ex-college players as well. But, you know, we're not going to be a professional side at this point.
So you mentioned there's a lot of teams in this league. Are there certain ones then that Kalamazoo will compete against? Will it be mostly teams in the Midwest, that sort of thing?
Yes. The division that we have has a lot of Michigan teams. It just really grew in the last few years. Detroit City's kind of a very well-known team, even nationally. They have had really good crowds, and they kind of their business model is a little different. They actually started playing downtown Detroit, and some five or six guys got together and started that franchise and really networked with the millennials in downtown, the people who live there, created a great atmosphere at the game, got people out, and you know they've done very well. But in this past year, Grand Rapids has now entered, and they played in a different league last year, but they had very big crowds, 4,000 and 5,000 people at the games. Ann Arbor's now entered. So, you know, we're going to have some local Michigan rivalries from a business model standpoint. It's great because travel is reduced, and we're not flying across the country or something like that to play one match. And we think fans will travel. I mean, there'll be some fans from Grand Rapids that comes down and watch us play against Grand Rapids when they're here, and I think the same thing will happen when we play up there.
for the soccer aficionado out there, and obviously you have some pretty extensive soccer experience yourself, but what would you tell them about the level of play? What can they expect to see in terms of how good a quality of soccer they'll have a chance to witness in Kalamazoo?
Yeah, that's I put the team together with a couple missions, hopefully not too many, but the first mission was I really wanted to provide an opportunity for some local players that are college players to have this opportunity locally, train and compete with this team and improve. So there's that intent to offer a development opportunity for local players. And then, of course, there's the intent to field as competitive a team as we can. And so we really want to blend that in with the best players we can recruit from college ranks. And again, some ex-college players, I'm sure, will participate to put out as good a team as we can. I want people to go to that game. You know, you've got a son who plays soccer. I want that 10-year-old to go to the game with his dad, have a great time, see a higher level soccer, hopefully educate them as like, wow, this is really fun. I understand now a little more about the game. I know a little bit more about what I need to practice, or I'm just really inspired by going to that game and seeing better players. When I was a kid, I grew up in Washington, D.C. I started going to pro games when I was probably 8 or 9. And it was inspiring for me. And at some point, I shifted from just an activity to something I really aspired to do or to get better. And I learned a lot. So I'm hoping something like that happens here.
When you look around Kalamazoo, you know, the K-Wings have been here for a long time. There have been a number of attempted soccer franchises. There have been some minor league baseball teams which have come and gone, and there's been varying degrees of success. As someone trying to bring an expansion team to Kalamazoo for soccer, do you look at any of that and think that there are some lessons to be learned in terms of what makes it successful and then sustainable?
There's always lessons to be learned, and the first one is pro sports at any level is not easy. I've been at every level of pro sports already as a player and coach and stuff, interacted on a lot of different soccer levels. It's not easy, and it's a challenge. I laughingly say, I started a lot of businesses. I'm good at starting things. I like to find people once I start them that can do all the heavy lifting, and I can just kind of, like I said, I have a vision for what we're trying to do and a passion for the game and the community, and I've got a few people that are still nameless that want to participate with me on this, and I basically, said, called up a few friends of mine that are passionate about the game and said, hey, I want your help, not your money. Let's get involved and make this thing happen for the kids here and for the community. And so we know it's not going to be easy, but we're committed to kind of making it as successful as we can. And I think it's really doable.
You've mentioned that you want people to go out and see, high quality soccer. Mm-hmm. Do you also have some thoughts on, what they call game day experience? Or do you think that there's other things that you might use to attract people that may not necessarily be, appealing to the hardcore soccer fan?
When you take the youth player who probably goes to a game and doesn't fully pay attention to the nuances of the game, right? You certainly want them to go and tell their mom or dad or whoever when they're driving home, that was fun, let's do it again. So there's certainly things you have to do, whether it be just items or things surrounding the event. It could be how you transform the venue you play into like really being a soccer venue. It could be having a mascot. It could be fun stuff at halftime and pregame and postgame. We're going to do all that. We're going to do all that. We realize that there's, at Soccer Zone is a great example. There's 10,000 people a week that play. Let's assume there's a few thousand adult players that play there every week that really enjoy the game. Their attitude about what they want at that game to make it a fun event for them may be very different than, say, the 10-year-old we're just talking about. So we've got to try to put out there an entertainment event, a sporting event, that appeals to more than just a diehard that you're asking about. So we're committed to doing that, and we want those kids to enjoy it and come back, so we have to.
You mentioned families. That's obviously, part of the sure. group you're trying to reach. Would you say there's other people in there that you think can be part of the audience that would watch soccer in Kalamazoo?
Well, the millennials. Soccer, there's a lot of people that have grown up now with the sport that maybe the previous soccer efforts in this community or elsewhere didn't grow up. It was their kids playing. And so they have already have a love of the sport or an enjoyment of the sport. And so There's already some efforts to put a supporters group together that will do this sort of pregame march to the game that is a big deal in some communities now. So those people get together and they might have a drink or two and they tailgate and then they march into the stadium together banging a drum and just really add energy and passion to the environment. And that, again, we're going to obviously encourage that and do what we can to help those people get organized and find more members.
Is community outreach, you know, maybe doing some things out away from your actual games and practices, also going to be a big part of what you do to try and get people to know, hey, there's a soccer team here?
Right. Yeah, we're planning a school program just to have players and people involved with the team interact with kids at school. We obviously do camps and clinics and that kind of thing so that young players in the community can come interact with the players on this team. We already do that kind of program through Soccer Zone, but it'll shift over to being a team function now, and we think there'll be a lot of interest in that. We will knock on doors. We have a lot of businesses that will come on board and get involved with us as advertisers and sponsors and stuff as well. So, again, at this stage, I would say we're laying that foundation and we're trying to crawl, walk, then jog. And when we get to the actual season, we hope we're at least jogging or running in terms of where we are in that process.
You mentioned the idea of a mascot. Do we have a nickname yet for this soccer team?
No, that's, again, another one. We have a team name, but we didn't develop a mascot, and that's something that we're going to look at, again, because of the question you had. We're knocking it around, too, is what do you want to do to engage those younger kids? Sometimes a mascot is part of it. You know, sometimes you need that sort of visible mascot to really appeal to the youth crowd, the younger ones.
You say there's a team name?
Kalamazoo FC is the team name.
Okay.
We have a logo that's been released. We just don't have sort of the nickname of, you know, we have the acronym KZFC that we came up with. We can see there our supporters group chanting that and kind of fits with KZOO was one of the suggested names for the team. We did a little fan engagement for the team name. And so, yeah.
You have a coach.
Working on the full coaching staff. It's like one of those things where we already are having players approach us. We have Nate Norman, who's an assistant coach. I'm sorry, who's the head women's coach at Western, who played in professionally a little bit and is really a good guy as an assistant coach. We're looking to round out a full staff that really kind of – I guess what I would say about that is there's several elements to, like, what we're after. And the player development – is, again, something that's just I've always focused on when I've been coaching. And so I'd really like to see us have a program here where a player comes from somewhere, let's say some college, and they're going to be here for 3 or 4 months to participate with this team. We want them to be able to leave and say to their college coach or to their college teammates or to whoever at the end of that time, what a great experience. Kalamazoo, a great place, had a great experience. The training was good. The team was good. Everything about that, I'm like really – I improved and I'm really prepared for my fall college season now. And so part of that is coaching and part of that is just the entire program we put together. So that's that coach piece is pretty important as well as just, like I said, focus on player development.
And in terms of long-term sustainability, do you think your reputation then becomes part of that? In other words, that if college coaches say, hey, I know I can send my players to
Absolutely.
Kalamazoo for the spring and summer, and they're going to come back at least a little bit better than they were when they left the first time, that the college coaches are going to look at Kalamazoo as a place where, yeah, I don't mind if my player goes there and plays. That'd be great.
For sure. And this league, there are college coaches and that obviously are looking to place their players or help their players find a place to participate in a league like this. Your question is exactly correct. If those players go back to their university team and they're playing Division I college soccer somewhere and they have a really sterling report about their experience in Kalamazoo, it certainly helps this team get those players back or other players, and it certainly helps that coach really encourage future players there.
Mike Garrett, thank you for your time.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate the help.
Mike Garrett is leading Kalamazoo's effort for an expansion soccer team. The National Premier Soccer League team will begin play this spring in Kalamazoo. Links with more about the new soccer team in Kalamazoo and a longer version of the interview with Mike Garrett can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.